This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting live worldwide on news, on information, vital to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they may live upon the earth, and certainly vital for all people as well. And I tell you, there's no doubt about the fact that Jewish supremacism does not only affect the European people. Look what's going on right now in Lebanon. It's a massacre. It's outrageous. And yet our leaders like Bush and other leaders, Jewish leaders, have the nerve to look us in the face and tell us about Arabic or other terrorism. And yet dropping bombs on apartment buildings in a major metropolitan area like Beirut or the people of Gaza, that's not terrorism. It's not terrorism when you drop firebombs and you burn to death little boys and girls. Of course, the media is very one-sided about it. But today I'm going to continue my spoken word version of Jewish supremacism. And today we're going to go into chapter 3, which is entitled Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And this chapter is not just important for Christians or Jews or Muslims. I think it's important for people of all religious or non-religious belief to understand the nature of Judaism. People often say, well, Zionism is bad or Jewish extremism is bad, but Judaism is fine. Well, Judaism at its core is an extreme racist religion. It is a racial religion per se that views the rest of mankind, not even as mankind, but as part of the animal kingdom. And these are the core beliefs in Judaism, and I will expose these beliefs to you in this particular chapter, and I think you're going to find it very interesting and very powerful and well documented. You can find the extensive documentation on all of this, of course, in my book, which has hundreds and hundreds of citations and footnotes, so you can check out everything I say, you know, for yourself. Here we go. This is the first part of Chapter 3, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. From the earliest times that I can remember, I have been a believing Christian. My father is a devout Christian who taught me about the salvation that Jesus Christ offers and about his lessons for living. Father was never dogmatic about his faith, and over the years he led my family to different churches without worrying about the denomination. At one time or another, we were members of Presbyterian, Methodist, and Church of Christ congregations. The only important consideration for my father was the quality of the minister and the congregation. When I was in grade school, my family joined the Elysian Fields Methodist Church, where my father taught Sunday school. When we traveled, we would almost always try to attend Sunday school and church in whatever city we happened to be in. The new perspectives we received from the different Sunday school teachers and preachers were like shots of adrenaline for our Christian faith. At 13, I went to Clifton Gaines School, a strongly fundamentalist Church of Christ school in New Orleans. At the same time, my family and I began to attend services at the Carrollton Avenue Church of Christ, which had strong ties to the school. Although I had an infant baptism in the Presbyterian Church, my new teachers and friends convinced me that the Bible taught that a conscious decision about salvation was needed before baptism. I prayed about it and gave myself to Christ, and I was laid back in the waters of the baptismal pool in our church's sanctuary. Not long after my baptism, after much pleading for me, my father found his way to the baptismal pool as well. Now, my experience of being a renewed Christian had a profound impact, not only on my Christian beliefs, but also on my secular ones, for it seemed I saw everything in a fresh light. When a man has confidence in his own beliefs, he's unafraid to joust with contrary opinions. Being saved gave me a sense of security that made me more open to different ideas. When someone has doubts about the underlying validity of his beliefs, he feels threatened by challenges to them. The feeling of being right with God and the world gave me freedom to explore challenging ideas. I knew that the New Testament offered a new covenant that included salvation for all. A few years after my baptism, as I reread the Old Testament in light of increased understanding of the Jews, I fully recognized its radical ethnocentrism. The Old Testament describes the history of one nationality, one people, the Israelites, who were designated as a special people, a chosen people. Life and death struggles between the Israelites and the Canaanites, Jacobites, Philistines, Amalekites, Assyrians, Egyptians, and dozens of other peoples are now recorded exhaustively. As I've mentioned in my chapter on Jewish supremacism, I was quite surprised and dismayed by the genocide that I continued to find in many more verses of the Bible, such as in Joshua 6:21 and 10:28 through 10:41. Dealing with the slaughter of entire peoples. The Jewish forces committed their genocide under the strict guidelines established by Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 20. He told them that in the lands that were set aside to become Israel, Jews should exterminate every inhabitant, while people in surrounding nations had to die unless they submitted themselves as slaves to Israel. I'll give you the exact quote, Deuteronomy 20, 10 through 18. When you draw near a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. And if its answer to you is peace and it opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and shall serve you. But if it makes no peace with you, you shall put all of its males to the sword. But the women and the little ones, the cattle and everything else in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as booty for yourselves, and you shall enjoy the spoil of your enemies. Thus shall you do to all the cities which are very far from you, which are not cities of the nations here, but in the cities of these people that the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance. You shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, the Hivites, and Jebusites, etc., etc. My friends, the wording is unmistakable. Even innocent children were to be killed simply because they were of an enemy nation. It became obvious to me that love thy neighbor had a very strange meaning in regard to the Old Testament. Since my earliest Sunday and Bible school days, I've been taught that the greatest instruction of God was to, quote, love thy neighbor as thyself, Leviticus 19:18. Having grown up on the Ten Commandments, the best-known passages of the Old Testament, I now wondered how such Old Testament genocide could be understood in the light of thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. I decided to look up in the scripture that discusses loving thy neighbor as thyself, and find out what its meaning actually is. I found it in Leviticus 19:18 in the Revised Standard Version, Old Testament, that belonged to my grandmother. The verse read, "You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against the sons of your own people, but shall love your neighbor as yourself." The following is the Jewish translation of the text for their Bible according to the Hebrew texts. This is from the Tanakh. "You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against your countrymen. Love your fellow as yourself." Now, the verse made it clear that neighbors then were not simply people near you, but they were sons of your own people. In other words, a neighbor meant a fellow Israelite and not other peoples. The most recent Jewish translation of the verse uses your countrymen in place of sons of your own people. The Talmud explains in Baba Kamma 113b that the term neighbor specifically does not apply to a Gentile. The Jewish Encyclopedia says it clearly. Here the Gentile is accepted as he is not a neighbor. Years later, I read an article by Dr. John Hartung in which he explained that the Ten Commandments' legal prescriptions were clearly directed at offenses against a, quote, neighbor, which excluded non-Israelites. He pointed out that the scrolls from which the Ten Commandments were translated had no periods, commas, or first word capitalization. Therefore, the part about thou shalt not kill becomes part of a larger context. Now here's part of the Ten Commandments read without punctuation. Thou shalt not kill, neither shalt thou commit adultery, neither shalt thou steal, neither shalt thou bear false witness against thy neighbor, neither shalt thou covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, or his manservant, or his maidservant, his ox, or his ass, or anything that is your neighbor's. So, by the Ten Commandments, who are the Israelites prescribed from killing? Thou shalt not kill thy neighbor, the children of thy people, the sons of your own people, your fellow Israelites. From this narrow definition of neighbor, the mass killing and theft of other people's lands became very consistent with the laws of the Ten Commandments. Now, as much as it may surprise many of the Christians reading this, the Old Testament also wholeheartedly supports the institution of slavery. The Bible makes it clear that Israelites may, quote, forever engage in slavery of other peoples, but they must not enslave their own. The passage is specifically, as for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may buy male and female slaves among the nations that are round about you. You may also buy from among the strangers who sojourn with you and their families that are with you, who have been born in your land, and they may be your property. You may bequeath them to your sons after you, to inherit as a possession forever. You may make slaves of them, but over your brethren, the people of Israel, you shall not rule one over another with harshness. That's from Leviticus 25:44-46. For anyone who doubts that passage, you can't get more clearer than that. There are also unmistakable passages condemning mixed marriages. Quote, and when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. Deuteronomy 7:26. And I am the Lord your God, which has separated you from other people. Leviticus 20:24. From Nehemiah 13:3, now it came to pass, when they had heard the law, that they separated from Israel all the mixed multitude. Now the Bible goes on to say to Israelites who marry non-Israelites, so will be the anger of the Lord kindled against you. Deuteronomy 7:4. Now the Old Testament decries the mixing of the holy seed of Israel. In other verses as well, Jewish priests complain that the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands, doing according to their, quote, abominations, Ezra 9:1. For they have taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, and that the holy seed have mingled themselves with peoples of the lands, Ezra 9:2. Ezra goes on to list 107 men who renounced their foreign wives and their children by them as part of their obedience to God. I also found that genealogies were used as proofs of untainted bloodlines. Racially pure genealogies were used to deny the priesthood to some who returned from Babylonian captivity. Genetic heritage is paramount in the Old Testament. As every reader of the Bible knows, the New Testament takes a dramatically different tone on ethnic matters than the Old Testament. The New Testament essentially says that salvation through Christ is available to everyone. The turn-the-other-cheek tone of the New Testament is quite a turn from the eye-for-an-eye dictum of the Old. As I became increasingly familiar with the role that organized Jewry played in communism, Zionism, and liberalism, I also noticed their animosity toward Christians. Hollywood produces an abundance of movies that attack Christianity, and the publishing establishment generates prolific anti-Christian literature. For instance, in my college days, I read a best-selling, highly promoted book called The Passover Plot, written by a Jewish scholar named Joseph Schoenfield. He alleged that Jesus had not died on the cross, but was actually drugged by his followers to fake his death and resurrection. Jewish organizations routinely lead the fight to ban Christian prayers from schools, prohibit the mention of Christ in public facilities, and even forbid the singing of Christmas carols in our schools. Once when I criticized Jewish organizations for such actions on a radio talk show, a caller called me unchristian for daring to criticize them. After all, he retorted, the Jews are God's chosen people. I had already done enough biblical research to know that such a statement, to told only the first half of the story. For the New Testament clarifies that believing Christians have become, quote, the heirs of God's promise, and that God no longer viewed the Jews as in his covenant. And I will document that in the next few pages for you. As I became more enlightened, I discovered that many Jews consistently endeavored to undermine the dominant religion and solidarity of any nation in which they dwell, or wherever it suits their purpose, such as agitating and militarily supporting the Christian phalangist minority and subsequent civil war in the nation of Israel's enemy, Lebanon. Looking into the historical attitude of the Christian church toward Judaism, I found that it had changed remarkably in the 20th century. This was a period that also marked the rise of Jewish economic, political, and media power. The Christian church had a long record of fundamental conflict with the Jews. It's a record of which Jewish writers frequently complain. In the early fledgling days of Christianity, Jewish persecution of Christians, as depicted in the Gospels and in historical accounts as well, was still fresh in the minds of church leaders. A former Pharisee, Paul, was one of those cruel persecutors until his miraculous conversion on the road to Damascus. Eventually, Christianity became an overwhelmingly Gentile faith, and organized Jewry became its implacable enemy, claiming that Jesus was a bastard and Mary was a whore, and that Christians were to be boiled in excrement. On the other side, using the New Testament, some Christians blamed Jews for the crucifixion of Jesus and the widespread persecution of Christians. Now, many Christians think that the Jews' only religious books are those found in the Old Testament. As I described in my chapter on Judaic supremacism, the Talmud is a collection of the chief books of the Jewish community. The American Heritage Dictionary describes it as, quote, constituting the basis of religious authority for traditional Judaism. Now, there are three main branches of the Jewish religion: Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. The Orthodox is the very traditional source of Judaism and is considered to be at its heart. Very similar to Orthodox, Judaism is the Conservative branch, but it offers some greater leeway in observance of the stringent Jewish laws. And more modernistic, the Reform movement is far less bound by Pharisaic traditions than either of the other branches. The Encyclopedia Judaica describes the current religious picture in the nation of Israel. There are very few Reform or Conservative congregations in the state of Israel. Orthodoxy is the official religious position in Israel, with the vast majority of the rabbis belonging to the old school of Talmudic jurists. The tendency within the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York has been emphatically toward a more Orthodox stance that existed within it in the previous generation. That's the Conservative Judaism article from the Encyclopedia Judaica. The Universal Jewish Encyclopedia makes it very clear that the Talmud, not the Torah or the Old Testament, is the supreme authority for Judaism. Now, this is a very important point. This is from Jewish Encyclopedia Authority, page 637. Thus, the ultimate authority for orthodoxy is the Babylonian Talmud. The Bible itself ranks second to it in reality, if not in theory. Now, the Talmud makes it clear that Judaism regards Jesus as a charlatan, magician, seducer, and deceiver. The Talmud also alleges that the New Testament account of the crucifixion was a lie, maintaining that Jewish priests, rather than Romans, had actually crucified Jesus. They maintain that they strangled him in a pit of dung and hated him so much that they executed him four different ways. The Talmud portrays Jesus Christ as the bastard son of a prostitute and even suggests that he was a Gentile. In some startling passages, it even boasts that Jesus Christ was conjured up from the dead by a Jewish magician and then punished for his heresies by being boiled in the hot semen. It's so hard to say these things. Below it, some direct quotes I confirmed from the Talmud dealing with Jesus and Christians. It says, Balaam, Jesus, fornicated with his jackass, Sanhedrin 105 AB. And I hate to even make these quotes. They're really obscene, but it's important that you understand what they are and where they are. Jewish priests raised Balaam, Jesus, from the dead and punished him in boiling hot semen. 57a, Gittin. She who was the descendant of princes and governors, the Virgin Mary, played the harlot with a carpenter. That's from Sanhedrin 106a. Jesus was lowered into a pit of dung up to his armpits. Then a hard cloth was placed within a soft one, wound round his neck, and the two ends pulled in opposite directions until he was dead. Sanhedrin 52b. It also says they gave him four different executions in Sanhedrin 106a. Hast thou heard how old Balaam, Jesus, was? Bloody and deceitful men shall not live out half their days. It follows that he was 33 or 34 years old. Those who read the uncanonical books, the New Testament, will have no portion in the world to come. That's Sanhedrin 90a. Jews must destroy the books of Christians. Sabbath 116a. Now, when I first encountered these Talmudic quotations, some of which were in Elizabeth Dilling's book, The Jewish Religion, such as those above and those reproduced in chapter 16 of my book, I told myself that they couldn't be accurate, that they had to be fakes or forgeries. Then I looked up the offending quotations and confirmed their presence in the Cencino edition, the most popular 20th century English translation of the Talmud. The anti-Gentile quotations also received ample coverage in the Jewish Encyclopedia, enough so that no one could seriously doubt their authenticity. The Jewish Encyclopedia even details how the English translations make use of code words such as Amalekites, Cuthians, Egyptians, heathens, and other monikers to denote Gentiles in general. Using these specific terms, the writers sought to hide from the Gentiles how viciously the Talmud speaks of them. It also says clearly that the word Balaam is a code name for Jesus Christ. Again, I went through this in my old chapter, in my last chapter, and I talked specifically, and I gave you the direct quotation from the Jewish Encyclopedia where they say that Balaam was in fact a word used to denote Jesus Christ. Now, as a younger man, I reacted to this hidden Jewish racism first with shock and then with anger. How could the liberal Jewish pundits and media moguls condemn those who simply exposed Jewish intolerance while their own holy writ taught hatred and violence against us, the non-Jews? When I began to talk publicly about the hatred that was in the Talmud, I was the one branded a hater. I was branded a bigot and an anti-Semite by the media and by groups like the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, the ADL. The ADL is a multi-million-dollar worldwide organization whose sole purpose is to defame and discredit those who simply tell the truth about Jewish supremacism and hatred against Gentiles. I became very upset, not only at the hatred I saw in the traditional Jewish writings, but also in the hypocritical attacks by the Jewish leadership on those who exposed Jewish intolerance. Over the years, they have frequently attacked me for simply quoting the Talmud publicly, when I did nothing but simply read directly from their own holy books. For exposing their hate, they call me the hater. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of the first part of Chapter 3 of Jewish Supremacism, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. I think that you certainly learned a lot, and we will continue tomorrow with Part 2 of the third chapter. And I hope that you'll be with me. Continue your good work, and please spread the word of this movement all over your neighborhood, your cities, your nation, and your world. Thanks. This has been David Duke.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddukedavidduke.com.